supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
It's behavioral disorders and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Hatred, fueled by race and ethnicity, has been part of our culture, part of our species since the very beginning of time. We know Romans persecuted Christians. America was a country built on the slavery of African Americans. Nazis murdered millions of Jews during the World War, and it moves up into the current day. We would think, we would hope these crimes of hatred, we would evolve beyond that. Unfortunately, they're as bad today, if not worse, than they've ever been. Even after the election of the first African-American president, we saw an increase in racial incidences, such as nooses and school buses, increase of hate crimes on college campuses, and an increase in gun sales. When a community is faced with such hatred, how can we heal? Can we heal? Joining us to discuss hate crimes, what it means, and what the healing possibilities are Chad Dion Lassiter. He's an adjunct professor at the University of Pennsylvania Graduate School for Social Policy and Practice. He teaches courses on American racism. Chad, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I'm also joined on the phone by Mark Potok. He's director of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Mark, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Mark, let's start with you. You draw a distinction between hate crimes and racial incidences. So an effigy hanging of Obama on a college campus, would that be an incident or a hate crime? What's the difference?
The difference is that there's an underlying crime that's defined, that is actually out there in the law, an assault, an act of a threat or criminal incitement or any one of a number of things, an assault and battery, whatever it may be. You know, in the case of an effigy hung on a university campus lawn, I would think there is no underlying crime. It might be different if you hung an effigy on someone's lawn in a way to try and intimidate that person. I think that pretty clearly would be a crime. But when you don't have an underlying crime, then it has to be an incident. It just doesn't rise to the level of a hate crime.
So the distinction has no bearing on how much harm it causes, because both...
That really is true. I mean, I think people commonly think when hate crimes are mentioned, people think of them as these independent category of crimes. In fact, hate crimes is merely shorthand for crimes which are punishable with a hate crime enhancement. In other words, if I assault you because you stole my girlfriend, I might get 6 months in jail. If it was because, I'm attacking you solely on the basis of the color of your skin or a category like that, I might end up serving 2 years. And that would come in the penalty phase of the trial.
My producer, Elisa Walters, talked to a young man who, when he was a college student, was assaulted by another group of students because he was Jewish. Let's listen.
We were going to unlock the gate, and seven kids walked up to us. Our backs were to them at first, and they started saying ethnic slurs. The kid facing my friend said, "You effing Jew," and then punched me, basically when I have his way to hit me. And they enclosed us in a circle, basically blocked us into the fence. And I went down and covered my eye. And my friend, the kid started to my friend, basically backed up and, he's like, "Do you want some of this?" And, my friend was just, going back and forth, looking, making sure I was okay because I was bent over covering my eye because it was bleeding. And he backed up a little bit, then the kid that hit me backed up a little bit and started to slowly walk away. Cops picked the kids up, five houses down.
What happened afterwards, after everything happened and you were hospitalized? What came about? Any charges?
They got 4 felony charges, and now it's going to trial.
Are any of these charges considered hate crime?
Yes. They're charged with ethnic intimidation, assault, or simple assault, hate crime.
Have you had any more contact with these guys?
I never had contact beforehand. I never knew who they were, never saw them in my life. And the only contact I've had with them is seeing them in the courtroom. They've never said a word like, I'm sorry, or anything along those lines. They didn't say anything negative to me, but they didn't say, like, sorry or anything. Didn't seem like it harmed them in any way.
Why do you think that this happened to you?
Basically, probably the wrong place, the wrong time. The one kid that hit me, his brother had, I was told afterwards, had gotten to like a fight or something along those lines at the Jewish fraternity that night. And he got his brother, I guess, to come back with him. And they were just looking for like a Jew or someone from a Jewish fraternity to take his anger out on.
How has this affected you?
I'm seeking, a psychologist. I had tons of doctor appointments, and it still bothers me to this day. I have nightmares sometimes about it, and just going out, like, I'm, like, paranoid about just running into these people or something along these lines, like, happening again. Because I never expected it to happen to me or anyone I knew ever. My grandfather went through the concentration camps, and I know what he went through, what he explained, but I never expected it to happen to me or anyone else I knew. So I'm basically like scared every time I go out.
Well, that was producer Elisa Walters talking with a young man who was assaulted because he was Jewish when he was a college student. He didn't want his name used. So, Mark, let's go back to you. First of all, crimes do seem to occur more frequently on campuses. There was an article I referred to in the beginning of the show that was written in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Why is that?
Well, first of all, let's say, it is university and lower school campuses are the third most common venue in America for hate crimes, which really is surprising, at least on the face of it, that after streets and in homes, residences. The last FBI report shows something over 11% of these crimes occur on campuses. I mean, why is that? I think for a couple of reasons. I think, first of all, people wrongly assume that university campuses are going to be kind of bastions of open-mindedness and so on. And I think the reality is that campuses really reflect the society that's around them. They're not so very different from the society that's around them. A couple of other things. One is that you get a lot of kids arriving at university who really have not been outside of a very narrow life until that moment. In other words, perhaps you've been raised in, an all-white or a virtually all-white suburb and really have no experience of other kinds of communities. And the final piece, it seems to me, is that these are, universities are places where young men congregate, and young men, as is, well known to all criminologists, are the people who commit the vast majority of all kinds of crimes, certainly crimes of violence, not just hate crimes. So I think those things working together are what really are behind the fairly large numbers of these things we see on campuses.
Chad, we heard a little bit, just a vignette of what happens when someone's a victim of a hate crime. And we heard what could be some early symptoms of PTSD. There's certainly emotional trauma, depression. But being a victim of a hate crime also means that you've spent a lifetime being part of a group that is hated, and that's what you bring into the situation. So tell us about the implications of that, of living in a group that is hated racially, sexually.
No, I think you're absolutely right. When we heard the young man articulate that, he thought maybe it had occurred simply because he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. As he further elaborated, he came to the vast realization that at the end of the day, in the final analysis, it might have been because he was Jewish. And so when we look at hate crimes and what other people use the terminology of bias-motivated crimes, we know that they occur when a perpetrator targets a victim because of his or her membership in a certain social group. And so you're absolutely right, Dan, in talking about these social groups and how they're defined as racial groups, religion, sexual orientation, disability, ethnicity, nationality, and sexual orientation. And so having that particular social group and being a target of a hate crime simply along those lines is really traumatic. And so the implications do lead to depression. It leads to post-traumatic stress disorder. It leads to not wanting to go to class, not wanting to go to school, not wanting to go to work, and things of that nature. And it can have profound impact for an extended period of time as well.
There's a study that just came out, I think last month, studying what happens to people who live in states that just legislated against same-sex marriage, Prop 8 in California, so on and so forth. And they looked at people in these states compared to other states, and their stress levels are up. And not just their own stress levels, but the stress levels of their extended families are up too. So what we're talking about is when we're living in a group that is hated or disliked by the larger public, I assume we live with a level of stress that's just there, that's just baseline.
High stress levels, also forms of coping. Do we cope adaptively? Do we cope maladaptively? And so if you look at what Jews have had to endure here, when you look at the lynchings of African Americans and just the challenges that African Americans and others across, you know, demographic lines have had to endure, the stress levels are high, forms of institutional racism, forms of just challenges that people have been dealing with as it relates to being marginalized, being oppressed, just dealing with the everyday occurrences really brings about a lot of health challenges for people on a day-to-day basis.
Let's widen the lens a bit, well, quite a bit, and let's go back to our history as humans. It's been around forever, racial and ethnic hatred. I'm sure it preceded the Jews being enslaved in Europe. I mean, we're you know, tribal people, and there's always one tribe that's going to be threatened by the other tribe. It continues in Bosnia and Darfur. Will it ever go away?
I think it's going to be with us for as long as we exist. But the challenge I think that we have to really look at is every day we should try to get up and try to find ways that we can combat it, we can dismantle it, and that we can actually do things from a social change perspective to bring about an end to it. I just think that, you know, when we look at it, as you articulated, that it's been with us throughout many centuries and it's going to continue. But I think that we still lend our passions, our hopes, our aspirations, as well as social change tactics to uproot it. So I think there are a lot of things that we could do to bring about effective strategies in combating hate crimes and forms of discrimination.
Let me ask you to play, it's unfair, play evolutionary psychologist for a minute. And I'm seeing if this has been around forever, must be there for a reason.
Well, you know, we have forms of xenophobia. We always look at people as strangers in our midst. If you look at some of the challenges that, you know, happened with the ethnic cleansing in Bosnia, there was someone who had to be a bully, and that's maybe not the right terminology to use, but there had to be someone that was in a position of power, and they wanted to oppress a person. If you look at what we went through in our history in the United States and the way that we've displaced the, you know, the Native Americans, and if we bring up to what happened with the Ku Klux Klan as well as African Americans, there seems to be someone who has to be inferior, and they want to make someone else to be inferior. And so one of the challenges that we've had is that we've always had this dynamic of other, and we've always seen people as other, and we've never really focused on our similarities. What we do is we magnify our differences twofold, and then what we do is we put some in a marginalized position.
Do you know in the Bible it says you shall imbue the head of a goat with all the sins of the people and banish the goat forever? And that is the origins of the concept of scapegoat. You know, all the stuff about yourself, your people that you want to disavow, you know, you attribute it to somebody else and you go after that that person.
Instead of looking, you're absolutely right. Instead of looking at our full humanity, looking at some of the challenges that we have, sometimes it's difficult to put the mirror up and look at some of the profound challenges that we have, some of the proclivities we have, some of the things that we do to people. So what we do is we try to scapegoat others. So we scapegoat gays and lesbians. We scapegoat disabled. We scapegoat the aging. But in reality, what we're looking at also with the emergence of hate crimes on college campuses is that a lot of young people are racially socialized. And so the caller is absolutely right, the gentleman that's also on the show with us, and expressing how it's learned in the home, it's learned in the school, and then they come to college campuses, and we think that college campuses are going to be filled with, you know, free thought in the sense that people are going to come in and like one another. And what oftentimes happen on these college campuses is they become more segregated. And so we have young people who don't really want to deal with race dialogue. They tiptoe through the tulips, they touchy-feely, and they really don't want to talk about some of the challenges that lie ahead. So we see these occurrences at Lehigh University, St. Joseph's University, and various other universities when Barack Obama becomes, you know, president-elect, and he wins the Democratic nomination. And we have people who are angry, because what does that mean to have an African-American male in the 21st century become the president of the United States? And so this hatred and all this animosity boils to the surface, and people maladaptively cope, and it manifests itself in a negative way.
Mark, is the precursor of this hatred, is it always fear?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess you could say it's always fear. I mean, I very much agree with what's just been said. I think that, you know, what scapegoating represents very often is an unwillingness to look at oneself. I mean, you know, look, many times major changes happen outside of oneself. You know, the economy goes to hell and you're in trouble and you feel like blaming somebody else. But very often it's because, you know, I dropped out of high school, therefore I can't get a job. I was lousy to my wife, therefore she left me. You know, I'm a poor businessman, therefore my business failed. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, rather than look within, how much easier to look down the street and say, it must be because that black family moved into my neighborhood, which used to be all white and, you know, wonderful and pristine and that kind of thing. So, you know, yeah, I think that these are essentially I think what's really worth saying is that these are people reacting to real things in irrational ways. But it's worth remembering that there are real things out there that are occurring. I mean, you know, in the case of anti-immigrant violence, which we've seen a real rash of over the last few years, you know, the reality is that this country is changing in pretty significant ways demographically. You know, so that does not mean that certainly assaults on supposed immigrants are in any way justified, but it goes some way toward explaining where some of this violence is coming from.
And it does. The underpinnings of that are anxiety and essentially fear of loss of something.
Abetted by, you know, a number of people out there, and I'm not just talking about white supremacist hate groups. You know, I think when we talk about, for instance, anti-immigrant violence, which really has dominated the scene for the last few years, you know, I think it's very unwise to forget the role that talk radio, that certain news, cable news television stations play, and so on, in demonizing immigrants. I mean, you know, that is very generally what precedes this kind of violence, a demonization of a group, you know, followed by attacks on the group. Well, and it's, I think, very surprising sometimes to understand that very often hate criminals are not, you know, the sort of bottom of the rung street thugs. They very often are young men who actually feel that they are doing the wishes of their community, that they are carrying out what their community would really like to say happen, although typically I haven't quite said it explicitly.
Hmm. Well, you know, you said we're going to have to take a short break, but, you know, speaking of those hate groups, Mark, you said earlier that we are in a worrying moment relative to hate groups. So after our break, I want to come back and talk to you more about that. And then later on in the show, we're going to talk with Novella Keith, who's a associate professor of urban education at Temple University, and she's got a very unique way of talking about how communities heal following racial tension and racial hatred. That's what we're talking about today, is racial, ethnic hatred, what it is, what the roots are, why it's getting worse, and what can be done about it. My guests here in the studio are Chad Dion Lassiter. He's adjunct professor at the University of Pennsylvania Graduate School of Social Policy and Practice. He was also involved in a student organization called Operation Understanding here in Philadelphia, and we're going to talk about that some more. I'm joined on the phone by Mark Potok. He's director of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
40 years since Martin Luther King's death, his impact remains strong. I'm Majora Carter. Join me on The Promised Land for a special program in honor of Dr. King. We'll take the long view on how far we've come since the brave days of the Civil Rights Movement, and we'll see how his influence has spread in all kinds of unexpected ways. Next on The Promised Land.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about hatred, racial hatred, hate groups, things that seem to have gotten worse over perhaps the last decade, and certainly worrisome in the wake of Barack Obama's election to president-elect of the United States. My guests are Mark Potok. He's director of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center. I'm also joined here in the studio by Chad Dion Lassiter, an adjunct professor at University of Pennsylvania Graduate School of Social Policy and Practice. He teaches a course on American racism. Chad, you made a comment during our break that this culture, this country, breeds hatred. How so?
I think America is one of the greatest places to live, and I don't mean that from a placating, ingratiating, or displaying with false generosity sense. And with all the wonderful things that we have occurred in the United States of America, we also have to take a candid look at the fact that America also has a dark side. And so if you look at what has happened to the Native Americans, if you look at what has happened with the Mid-Atlantic slave trade, and when you look at what happened during Jim Crow and the way several civil rights leaders and Jewish leaders as well were treated during the civil rights movement and various other movements. There's a segment of the population, whether we call them white supremacists, neo-Nazis, that breeds hatred. And it's really profound that, you know, that's one of the things that we really don't talk about. It's not really in our textbooks. It's not anything that, you know, people really want to grapple with. It's just something that we become disillusioned about. There is something that we're in a state of denial about, or maybe we just have a mindset of amnesia. But it's something that we definitely need to look at, and it's something that we need to really talk about. When we look at the racial contract and everything that is Eurocentric and everything is, you know, presupposed to be, you know, nothing getting developed into, you know, Europeans got there. And then when we look at the fact that we discount the experiences of white women as well, our election even showed that. Yes, we have 43 presidents who were white, and now we have one African-American president, but we have no women presidents. The bias discrimination from a gender perspective that was, you know, displayed throughout the election towards Hillary Clinton. And so I think we just need to really talk about, you know, the stain of America and some of the dark side of America. Doesn't mean that we don't love America, or we just need to make sure that we talk about America for what it really is and the promise of what it can become.
Mark, do you agree that this country breeds hatred, and what makes this a worrisome moment for you?
Well, I'd say a few things. I mean, first of all, I'm not a professional in this area, but my gut feeling is that, you know, you put any two groups of people together and the better armed group is going to oppress the less well armed group. I mean, that just seems to me to be the history of the world. I realize that's vastly simplifying a great deal. I will also note an interesting thing about the people who enter at least today's hate groups. There's been a lot of work, some of our own work as well as some serious academic work, which shows that a very large proportion, almost certainly a majority of people who go into these groups, in fact, do not go in for reasons of racism or anti-Semitism or hatred of gay people or any of the things one might expect. They go into these groups for very much the reasons that kids join other kinds of street gangs. And that is essentially, or at least in a large number of cases, because their own family is in terrible shape. They have some kind of dysfunctional family or family with a lot of difficulties, and essentially they go out and form an alternative family on the street. So I think that doesn't, you know, if one believes that that is true, that's a little different than saying the American experience kind of, in and of itself engenders a kind of racial animus that's different than other societies. To answer the second question, why do we feel worried now? You know, I think that what we're seeing right at this moment, of course, we've seen this big rash of incidents right at the end of the election and immediately after Obama's election, real racially charged incidents. I think right at this moment there's more, too, that's going on. And let me just tick off what I think are the factors out there. One, we have continuing quite high levels of non-white immigration, principally Mexican and Central American immigration, and that is driving a lot of animus in this country. Two, the prediction by the Census Bureau just a few weeks ago that by the year 2042, the United States would lose its white majority, its 50% plus one white majority. And that, believe it or not, is driving certainly the groups I cover quite out of their minds. They're really beating their breasts over this one. Three, of course, is the economy and the absolute certainty of coming worsening unemployment in the months to come. And then four, of course, is the idea of a black man in the White House. I think when you put all of these things together, for some subset of white Americans, it gives them the feeling that somehow they've been robbed, that the kind of Christian white country they imagine their forefathers built has been stolen away from them. So, you know, I guess what I'm saying is there's a kind of identity crisis going on among some whites. I think it has calmed down quite a bit since the election of Obama, and maybe that's a promising thing or a hopeful thing. But certainly all these factors I've mentioned are the kinds of things that can engender the growth of these groups. It won't necessarily happen, but I certainly think there's a lot in place there that could help these groups continue to grow.
Chad? I think also, and I agree with you wholeheartedly, Mark, but I also think that at the root of it is also white supremacy. And I'm thinking that there are going to be some predictors that are going to lead to even more hate crimes because we have not gotten to the inauguration yet. And so there's going to be some manifold challenges that are going to emerge. So I think it's also based on whether it's real, perceived, or imagined that that subgroup are those, whether or not they're joining it because it's a gang, it's a family, they're coming from a dysfunctional home. Is let's look at it from a racial socialization in addition to a racial identity perspective. When you're talking about the desecration of synagogues, when you're talking about damaging of property, when you're talking about church burnings, and when you're talking about, you know, going into Jewish daycare centers and attacking children, I think that's more than just, and I'm not saying that you articulate this, Mark, but that's more than just joining a group because I come from Western PA, dysfunctional family, the economy is messed up. That's hatred.
I totally agree. I mean, I don't mean to interrupt you, Chad, but I totally agree and only mean to suggest that the way people start down this road, in many cases, of course, you know, once you're in these groups, then everything works to build up racial hatred in you, and the whole, you know, everything supports that idea. And I guess I just want to say, I don't mean to interrupt you.
Well, let me take the position here of the naive interviewer, if I may, and turn to you, Chad. One could argue that racial hatred is based partly, in large part, on ignorance, a combination of ignorance and anxiety. Theoretically, one would think that hate crime would be diminishing as this country really is becoming more of a melting pot. You know, there are more people of more subtle colors than ever before, so there should be less ignorance, less hatred.
But there still is ignorance, and I like the question that you posed, but I think it goes back to what Mark stated in the sense that we have these groups, and when these groups come together, there's still a group that perceives that they need to have advantage and another group needs to be disadvantaged. And so what we have is, yes, we see an increase in interracial dating, interracial marriages. We see more groups assimilating into one another's culture. We see a lot of people doing a lot of things around cultural holidays and things of that nature, but there's still that underlying underlying current that's based on this whole, you know, notion of privilege, you know, someone's advantaged, someone's disadvantaged. And I think that's where therein lies some of the challenges that we're seeing on our college campuses.
I listened to both of you, and what I'm hearing, and I'd like both of you to react, is that the fact that a black man will be in the White House is not going to have much of an impact on the dialogue or in changing these broad brush dynamics that both of you are talking about. Mark, let me start with you.
Well, I mean, I think the election of Obama is a huge and truly remarkable milestone in the history of the country. I mean, we have made, whatever one may think of the specific policies and politics of Barack Obama, it's a remarkable thing and a thing a person like me never thought I'd see in my life. So, you know, not to take anything away from that, nevertheless, we see these kinds of backlashes, and I don't think it's unexpected. I think that we can continue. I expect to see that continue in some form. You know, whether or not it kind of heats up around the inaugural, we will see, but it seems quite possible. You know, I'd like to just make one side point, if I may, which is that the truth is we don't know if hate crimes are increasing or if they're diminishing. It may well be that from the very beginning, our society, or perhaps societies in general, have seen this level of hate crimes. You know, we know for a fact that the FBI hate crime statistics cannot tell us if hate crimes are going up or down, because the system is voluntary, and, you know, I won't bore listeners with all the details, but there are very many problems with these statistics. The important point, it seems to me, is that the FBI stats show between about 6,000 and about 10,000 hate crimes a year, depending on the year. The reality, though, as shown, I think, very definitively by a government study, Department of Justice study in late 2005, is that the real level of hate crimes out there, they concluded, was about 191,000 incidents per year. That's, 20 to 30 times what the FBI is reporting. So regardless of whether these crimes are going up or down, and regardless of what it may mean historically in comparison to other societies or our own society at other times, the point is that there are a great many of them out there. And therefore, this is not a minor social problem. This is a major problem that, I think we're obliged to confront as a society.
I think having Barack Obama as the President of the United States provides us an opportunity to have a race dialogue, whether or not Barack Obama calls for it. I think what it does is it provides an opportunity for people in the academy, people in the community, and people in their households to talk about things that make them uncomfortable and things that make them comfortable. And so I think it's a starting point. I think it's, for America, it's a pregnant moment as we give birth to a new identity, a new reality of what could possibly be become.
So speaking of new identities, new realities, tell us about Operation Understanding.
Operation Understanding is a program started here in the city of Philadelphia by former Congressman Bill Gray, who also served as the pastor at Bright Hope Baptist Church, and also a Jewish gentleman from Goldman Sachs. And what Operation Understanding wanted to do was bring together a cadre of African-American rising high school seniors and Jewish-American high school seniors in the city of Philadelphia and show them that there are more similarities than there are differences. And a lot of this actually, Dan, had come about in 1985, directly after the comment that Jesse Jackson made about entering New York and calling it Hymie Town. And so what Operation Understanding seeks to do is take both the African-American high school seniors, and the Jewish-American students, and take them on an excursion of a journey, so to speak, of cultural diversity. 2 weeks are spent in Senegal, 2 weeks are spent in Israel, and then the students come back to the city of Philadelphia and they work on a service project in various communities one Saturday out of the month. Wonderful experience, and I happened to have an opportunity and was fortunate, and even more so than being fortunate, I was blessed with an opportunity to go to Africa and Israel. And what we saw both in Africa and Israel was that both African Americans and Jewish Americans face a lot of challenges. And what I was able to see in those comparative analyses was that both populations are resilient. Both of them stare adversity in the eye, and both of them bounce back. And so whether I was at the door of no return in Senegal at Gori Island or at Yad Vashem, I still was able to observe and witness both African Americans and Jewish Americans full humanity on display and the atrocities that both groups face with. And the students were able to learn from one another. So what we did was we paired, you know, a black student with a Jewish student, and they would, you know, sleep in the same room with one another. We would eat together. We immerse ourselves in both the African culture as well as the Jewish culture. When we were at the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, it's just a beautiful sight to have African-American students and Jewish-American students along with the Orthodox Jews and the ultra-Orthodox Jews and everyone just praying at the wall. It was just a fascinating experience, Dan.
Well, after we take our break, we're gonna be talking with Novella Keith, and we're going to talk more about what it takes to heal. Mark, before we take our break and before we have to say goodbye to you, Southern Poverty Law Center has a wonderful program on teaching tolerance that partly, I believe, is based on the life of Gerda Weissman Klein. Tell us about the program and how it's being used.
Well, the program basically provides materials to, I believe, about 650,000 teachers around the country, free materials. They are largely, there are two components, really. There is a semi-annual magazine filled with direct advice for teachers and so on, teaching plans and so on. And then there are also kits built around films, several of which have actually won Best Short Documentary Academy Awards. One of those films was, in fact, about Gerda Weissman and her experience on the death marches at the end of the Second World War. So that is our program. You know, we essentially have two programs, one which battles hate as it exists out there in the world today, and one which is aimed at the kids of tomorrow.
How does one find out more about these programs?
The easiest thing would be simply to go to our website, www.splcenter.org. Or if people are interested in looking directly at our investigative work having to do with hate groups, they might want to go straight to www.intelligencereport.org, where the material my department produces is.
Well, Mark, we're going to have to take that break and say goodbye to you. I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. And I wanted to mention to Chad that I believe the Operation Understanding people come to visit us every year, too. So I've spoken to at least some groups a number of times, and they are just a terrific bunch of kids.
Thanks a lot, Mark, and continue the awe-inspiring work that you are doing down there. I've been able to use some of your materials for some of my courses at the University of Penn. So thanks for all the things that you're doing as well as a social change agent.
Yeah, I encourage everybody to look at that website for the Southern Poverty Law Center. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have Chad Dion Lassiter again with us, who's an adjunct professor at the University of Pennsylvania Graduate School of Social Policy and Practice. But we'll also be joined by Novella Keith, who's an associate professor of urban education and is doing some wonderful job on community healing. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
One Book, One Philadelphia, a project of the Office of the Mayor and the Free Library of Philadelphia, supports WHYY, media partner. In Philadelphia, everyone is reading The Soloist by Steve Lopez, a story of the bond between a journalist and a homeless classically trained musician. More than 100 One Book events for children and adults will take place through March 18th, including book discussions, musical performances, family workshops, and film screenings. Details at freelibrary.org.
Visit exotic places.
You know, in another month, you don't want to be here, but right now, it's primo.
Meet fascinating people.
There's going to be fights and people drinking. It's what you do on Saturday night.
And enjoy fine conversation.
You look like a cowgirl.
You're the first person that made me feel like I fit.
No, I meant that.
It's what great radio is all about.
Okay.
Join us for NPR's Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about racial hatred today, and we're talking about healing racial hatred, both those who have been victims, perpetrators, and healing communities that have been living with it. I'm joined, as promised, by Novella Keith. She's an associate professor of urban education at Temple University. Among many of her publications, her most recent book is Getting Beyond Anemic Love, From Pedagogy to Cordial Relationships for Making a Difference. She's got a book in progress called The Engaged University, A Practical Guide. Novella, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan.
And we're also joined by Chad Dion Lassiter, an adjunct professor at the University of Pennsylvania Graduate School. He teaches a course on American racism. I wonder, Novella, if the fact that communities are more isolated today than ever before, does that increase the risk for discrimination and prejudice?
Absolutely. I heard before that one of the things that happens, for instance, in universities is that students come, certainly the students who come to Temple, not only to Penn, come from pretty segregated communities. In the College of Education, we have the typical population that's a lot of young, white, middle-class women. And one of the things that we do is we try to introduce them to urban schools. And the first thing that happens when they think of going into North Philly and so on is fear that sometimes they speak about and sometimes they don't. And sometimes you have to sort of draw it out and help them reflect on what it means, what the causes are, what the realities are.
I'm wondering about the big picture. You know, when I read Putnam's book, and we had him on the show about Bowling Alone and his subsequent work and others, that we really are becoming more isolated and spending more time with people who look like we do and think like we do more than ever before. And I just wonder if that increases the risk for ignorance and therefore hatred.
For sure. I think that one of the things that universities should do, but not only universities, I think we have opportunities. You know, a lot of times we get together at work, and then we go our separate ways to communities, to our churches, and so on. And so I think that what we must do now, we really have to lead toward a new kind of democracy, a democracy that helps us to recognize and to live with all of this diversity. And some of the issues that your previous speakers were saying about, for instance, the demonization of the other, and how do we use, that's what I'm really interested in, how do we use the spaces that we have, whether it's at the university, whether it's in our work together, to move toward a democracy where we understand ourselves as well as others?
Well, Novella, you're here in the studio, and unfortunately you're the expert, so I'll ask that same question of you. So how do we move in that direction now? Let's make you in charge of all this in this country. So how do we have that dialogue?
So sort of a special dialogue kind of czar.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
The work that I've done, one of the issues is how can we teach what we don't know? There is a lot of work, for instance, the teaching tolerance project that you were talking about before is simply fantastic. It's just wonderful. They have incredible ideas. Many of them work very well. But as teachers, as facilitators, as professionals, we have learned some of those things that we need to unlearn. A lot of racism, a lot of the hate needs to be unlearned. And if we don't know, so I think that at some level, it has to start with us, with the professionals, and that's why my book that I'm working on is really about how do we create a new cadre of professionals, including teachers, who are able to do this work.
Chad Novella's been talking about discrimination and prejudice, but at what point does that morph into hatred and even violence?
I think it morphs into hatred and violence when we're not dealing with it from the perspective of education. And so she's absolutely right in the sense that we need to educate our teachers, we need to also educate our social workers, and all those service providers who are dealing with various populations. And I think what happens is if people aren't willing to do the hard work of being self-introspective, working on their own humanity and their own liberation to unlearn those behaviors that they were primarily racially socialized to display with, then it can turn into hate. So if there are some mixed messages, so you have these teach for tolerance curriculums, if we're dealing with conflict resolution, if we're dealing with anger and aggression curriculums in our urban schools as well as our suburban schools, I think what the profound challenge is going to be if people aren't willing to grapple with the notions that they've been, you know, brought up to believe in, the things that are remotely embedded in, into who they are, and really try to create a new identity for them. And I think that we can do that by teaching young people as early as fifth grade, sixth grade, or if not even earlier, make it, you know, specialized and tailored to a point where they can really learn about other ethnicities and just other people in general.
Hmm. Can I add something?
Please.
See, I think for me the issue is how do you move, how do you understand that what seems really personal is actually institutional and societal? I'm a sociologist, and so I suppose that's my natural inclination.
So give an example.
All right. For instance, if I feel hatred, the hatred comes perhaps because of the way I was treated in my family. And so... And perhaps it comes also because my parents maybe, you know, the classic lost jobs and were mistreated and so on. But where does that come from? That that lack of respect, for instance, is inscribed in the society for certain groups. One of the things that we don't talk about enough, really, I think, in this country is social class, working class. And a lot of times when we talk about white hatred, it's really... poor working class people who are encouraged, if you will, by politicians and others to take their anger out on people who are easy victims. So,
what do you mean encouraged by politicians?
Well, you can, fascist kind of politics, for instance, such as you've seen in this country, certainly some people have talked about, you know, versions of friendly fascism in the United States. Certainly right now, for instance, in Europe, you see a lot of right-wing politicians. In my own country of origin, Italy, there are secessionist movements actually now, and there are people who want to separate on the idea of this sort of ethnic purity that sounds very much like the ethnic purity that the Germans used to talk about. And all of that is linked to a politics and an economics of scarcity. So I think if we don't see all of these things interconnected, the social and the political and the economic, we're not going to get anywhere.
Well, I see you nodding your head, Chad, in agreement. The question I have as a clinician who sits in my office working with families or individuals is, how do we do that? How do we begin to change a dialogue in a society?
I think it's going to be really complex, and I'm, you know, really wholeheartedly and earnestly going to state that it's not something that's rocket science. It's really actually harder than rocket science. And so whether we do it from a group therapy standpoint, individual psychotherapy, what we have is hurt people who hurt people, and what we have to teach hurt people to do is how they become, they can be morph into becoming wounded healers. What's a wounded healer? A wounded healer is someone who's going through physical abuse, sexual abuse. They've witnessed domestic violence in the home. Their parent might have gotten laid off, but they don't maladaptively cope. They adaptively cope by continuing to stay in the moment and learn from that process. And so what we have is, when you look at a city like Philadelphia, we have the model minority myth, and we have a lot of students who are beating up on immigrant students in various pockets of the community. Well, where's that coming from? Well, maybe an articulation in the home where mom says, you know, well, look at all the Chinese stores that happen to be readily available in our community, and there are a lack of supermarkets. Well, what she's really talking about is structural inequality and what that needs to look like. But what happens is the son or the daughter interprets that differently. And so what they say is, let's go in the community and let's beat up on someone. And so I think that it's a lot of therapy. But there are a lot of challenges that we have, and I'm not so certain that this is something that's going to occur overnight. It's a gradual progression, so we're going to have to gradually try to find our ways out of this. And there are many things that we can do. One of the things that we do at the University of Pennsylvania with our graduate students of social work is we give them a full-year course on American racism, looking at the black-white binary, white privilege, black skin disadvantage, oppression, things of that nature. The second semester, we look at how you can become social change agents. We know that all change is from the bottom up, not from the top down. And so we're teaching social workers to morph from being social workers to being social change agents, because various times, Dan, they get into these various communities and they really don't know how to interact with people who don't look like them.
You talk like about change coming from the bottom up instead of the top down. There's a community organizer that I've grown to know pretty well over these last couple of years that uses exactly that that same language. Novella, I want to talk about our background. Mm-hmm. When I first met you was several years ago around the work of a psychologist, French psychologist named Charles Rosman. Tell us about the work that he's doing, that you're doing with him in terms of healing communities.
Thanks for bringing that up. I was just thinking about that very thing. Charles Rosman has been working for the past 20 years or so, and he developed a process that he calls transformational social therapy, starting from a background in therapy, in group therapy. He brings together groups that are different and groups that are in conflict. One of the things that we tend not to do very well, I think, in this country when we deal with conflict resolution is deal with conflict and let conflicts out. He distinguishes between violence and conflict. And when people don't know each other, when they don't have a relationship, they are violent toward each other. But so how do you bring a group together of people who hate each other even? For instance, in an organization. So what he has done is bring together, let's say, policemen and young hoodlums. And out of that process, he takes them to the process, and it really does not take all that long. And I think it is something that we could do on community and even citywide. We've had dialogues on race. This would be bring together people who hate each other and take them through a process where they learn to see the humanity of each other, and then from that identify something that they can do together that they want to do, that is their project to heal the community.
I have watched his work and done some work with him, and I've noticed that he doesn't shy away from the hatred. You know, all of our instinct is to deny it, to make it better. He doesn't. He allows it to come out and even flourish, to have its voice.
Yes. I think one of the things that I've been struggling with is the idea of being vulnerable enough in yourself to be able, how do you lead a group like that, in other words? And that's partly what I was talking about before in teaching teachers and teaching facilitators how to do that. I think there, if you have a certain awareness in yourself, because hatred comes from your own reaction, your own fear of judgment, your own fear of being left alone, your own fear of being attacked and so on. And what we tend to do when someone comes at us, we react defensively. If as a group facilitator, and I think he does that marvelously, you have enough knowledge of yourself to not react defensively, but then to even show, to say exactly what you're feeling, and then you become the model of the wounded healer.
Well, and that's the wish, isn't it? As this is where we all come together from various perspectives, that if we could have our feelings, if we could understand them, look at them, and tolerate them and not have to act on them, then that's the beginning of the end of this nightmare that has been racial hatred. I want to thank both of you so much for joining us. It's been an important and an informative show. My guests have been Chad Dion Lassiter. He's an adjunct professor at the University of Pennsylvania Graduate School, and he teaches a course on American racism. We were joined earlier by Mark Potok. He's a director of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Novella Keith is an associate professor of urban education at Temple University, and her book in progress is called The Engaged University, A Practical Guide. And it's due out in 2010. Well, if you want to reach us, we're at voices@whyy.org. I'm at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Kevin Griffin. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer for radio content. Mike and Scott's the executive producer of Voices in the Family. We're co-produced by Lisa Walters and Gita Simons. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Have a good week, my friends.